First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
School boards across Florida are standing up to Governor DeSantis. Are they on solid legal ground? Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, we'll tell you what the law says about the power of local school boards to look after the health of their students in this fight over mask mandates. Give us a call, 549-2937. Then later, why local lawyers say a mask order for the courtrooms around town and the region isn't being followed, even by the judges. But first this morning, despite the governor's ban and his threats, school boards across Florida are voting to require masks for students as classes resume around the state this week. The governor and his commissioner of education, Richard Corcoran, are threatening to withhold the paychecks of education officials who defy them on this. Now, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the American Academy of Pediatrics recommend that all K-12 through 12 students wear masks for in-person learning right now, especially here in North Florida, where the Delta variant of coronavirus is filling up local ICUs. Just yesterday, Mayor Lenny Curry announced several new testing sites around town for COVID-19 to meet the incredible demand.
There could be another variant. When we get through this, we're just going to have to adapt and work together as a community.
So we are in a public health crisis right now. And when it comes to this issue in our schools, we decided to find out what the Florida Constitution actually says about the power of local school boards to make these decisions. Here are some answers for you. We're pleased to welcome Jacksonville attorney Chris Hand. He specializes in government law. He is the co-author of the book America, the Owner's Manual, with former Florida Governor and Senator Bob Graham. And Chris is also the former chief of staff for the city of Jacksonville. Chris Hand, always good to get your legal insights. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Great to be with you as always.
Give us a call, already getting your calls, as we talk about what the Florida Constitution says about the power of local school boards. And we're talking, too, about local control and home rule. Let us know your thoughts about all this. 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInjax. So, Chris, the governor has threatened to withhold the paychecks of school board officials and superintendents who defy him and mandate masks for students. Seven or eight districts, by my last count, are going ahead and doing this, although they are, in some cases, offering an opt-out for parents. Is the governor within his rights by threatening to withhold pay to education officials who defy his emergency order?
Melissa, in a word, no. One of the many challenges with the executive order and the resulting rule is incompatibility with the Florida Constitution. As most people know, the Florida Constitution is our ultimate governing document here in the state of Florida. Any state action has to be consistent with the Florida Constitution. And as other attorneys like education law expert Ron Meyer have pointed out, the Florida Constitution couldn't be more clear. Let's just kind of go to the text a little bit here. Article 9 is the part of the Florida Constitution that governs the issue of education. In Section 1, the Constitution mandates, not a suggestion, it's a mandate. It uses that word shall that we're familiar with here in Jacksonville, mandates a safe system of free public schools. And then, again, another mandate in Section 4, the Constitution says that school boards shall operate, control, and supervise all free public schools within their districts. You add those together, and it is local school boards that have authority to make decisions on issues like mask mandates to protect the health of their students and teachers, school staff, and, of course, others in the school system, not the governor.
There are already a couple of lawsuits filed around this, one at the state level, one at the federal level, on behalf of Florida parents. There is a hearing Friday, I believe, in Leon County that is calling for injunctive relief on this. We'll follow that. But But Chris, let's say the governor follows through and actually withholds the paychecks of some of these officials. What then?
Well, Melissa, as you may have seen, there's already been some. I mean, this issue has, as it's continued to evolve, there have been initial statements, and then there has been some evolution to the state government's position. You know, for example, initially, it was indicated there would be an outright ban on mask mandates. Then that became sort of hope scholarships and allowing mask mandates as long as there was an opt-out. So one of the other areas where kind of the state government position on this has evolved, it was talked about that, you know, the state would stop paying superintendents and school board members. Well, in the letter that Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran has sent to several school districts, including Broward County, Alachua County, and Leon County, all of which have adopted mask mandates, what he said was not that they would withhold salaries anymore, but that they might withhold the equivalent of salaries from funding. So just to give people a sense of what that means numerically, when it was originally sort of out there that they might withhold all state funding here in Jacksonville, I believe that that the superintendent here in Duval County indicated that that could be somewhere around $600 million if all state funding and grant funding were to be withheld. If you add up the salary of the superintendent and school board members, probably closer to about $600,000. So still a significant amount of money, but very different from what we were originally talking about. So again, it's just part of that continued evolution of the, you know, of what the state government's position is on these issues.
549-2937. What about the argument that it's too little too late for school boards to stand up like this in the defense of local decision making and home rule? People tweeting the show say that local control of school systems has already been eroded, if not completely eliminated, when it comes to how charter schools are funded and supervised in this state, that it has reduced school boards to a largely ceremonial role. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, my thoughts are that that's a decision that ultimately will be made in the court system. As you indicated, there are already lawsuits that parents in the state have filed. There's one in state court in Leon County. There's one in the U.S. District Court for Southern Florida. You had attorneys from both of those legal teams on the show yesterday. So I don't think it's too little too late at all. I suspect that these decisions are going to ultimately be decided. But Melissa, it's important to remember, you know, both the governor and school board members in this state take the exact same oath of office. And one of the primary parts of that oath of office, which can be found in Article 2 of the state constitution, is a pledge to support and defend the Florida Constitution. That is one of the most fundamental aspects of any public official's duty. And as I indicated before, the Constitution could not be more clear about who has the authority to make decisions on these types of issues. So those issues, I think, are going to get resolved in some of the litigation that's filed, either or both in state and federal court. And I strongly suspect that the result could be a reinforcement of the local authority to make these kinds of decisions.
And this is happening, by the way, across the state. Broward County in South Florida, last night there was an intense school board meeting in Leon County in Tallahassee. Thousands of people watched it on Facebook Live, Chris. In the end, the superintendent there backed down just a little bit, saying that he will give parents in Leon County schools an opt-out provision, but that they would continue to consult with attorneys to see how they can fight the state on this matter. And so it's been remarkable to see local officials flexing in this way and standing up to what critics say is partisan bullying and an unconstitutional overreach of executive authority.
Well, I think that's probably for a couple of reasons, Melissa. One, that oath of office I talked about and their clear constitutional authority on this. But the authority that one has in office becomes a lot less theoretical and a lot more real when you're talking about issues like the health of kids, particularly kids under 12 that can't be vaccinated. So I suspect that's why you're seeing these positions that different school boards around the state are taking right now. They have the ability under the law, as we've talked about under the Florida Constitution, to operate, control, and supervise public schools. And the way in which they do that could very well make the difference in whether kids get sick. And God forbid, even if kids go beyond getting sick and you know, die as a result of COVID. We saw a very tragic case of that here in Jacksonville just last week. So I know that school board members across the state understand the gravity of this issue. This isn't just a constitutional issue. It's an issue of life and death. And I think that's why you're seeing some of the reactions that you are from school boards. They want to be able to do their jobs. They want to be able to fulfill their oaths of office. Not just to support and defend the Florida Constitution, but also to support and defend children, teachers, school staff who could be at risk from this deadly pandemic.
549-2937. As we speak with government law attorney Chris Hand, let me plug his book, America, the Owner's Manual, which he co-wrote with former Florida Governor, former Senator Bob Graham. I recommend this for anyone who wants to better understand our system of government and how you can be a better citizen. Okay, 549-2937. David in Middleburg. Hi, David. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. How are you doing?
Okay.
Yeah, for a party that claims to be so pro-life, the Republican Party, isn't this a step backwards when you don't want to vaccinate, especially when you got children involved? It's another whole game now. Now the children can't speak for themselves, and now they become a pawn in a political game, which nobody wins.
Thanks, David.
I'll take your answer off the air.
Thank you. You know, Chris Hand, let me ask you about this. You've worked in local government. You worked on Capitol Hill in Washington. Now, let's be clear. You've mainly worked for Democrats. But as we've typically understood the differences between the two major parties, we tend to have always have thought about Republicans as really valuing home rule, local control, resisting top-down mandates, devolving government down to the local level as much as possible with the idea that local officials know what's best for their local communities. And so it's really been remarkable to see the governor completely throwing that value, that sort of smaller government, more conservative value, out the window with this whole thing.
Well, and Melissa, it's a value that's embedded and enshrined in the Florida Constitution. I mean, in addition to, you know, Article 9, which I talked about, which gives authority to local school boards, of course, Article 8 provides authority to counties and cities, you know, both county and municipal governments, to exercise their powers, you know, what you just referred to in terms of home rule. So it's not just a, you know, a function of what one political party believes or the other. This is a set of values that's embedded in the Florida Constitution, which is why I suspect you're seeing frustration from school board members, whether they are Democrats or Republicans, from around the state. Constitutionally, this is their job to operate, control, or supervise public schools. This is squarely within their decision-making authority, what school board policies are going to be as it relates to masking or other COVID protocols. And so I imagine it's not just been on this issue, of course, we've seen in recent years, whether it's this issue or a variety of others, there has become a bit of a Tallahassee knows best attitude on a variety of issues. And, you know, we're seeing it most recently on this issue related to masks. But again, this is just going to be the latest issue of the relationship between state government authority and local government authority, or state government authority and citizen authority, that's going to be litigated. There's been recent lawsuits on some other issues related to this. The issue of masking is just the latest of efforts to resolve this dispute, which should be resolved by virtue of what's in the Constitution, but clearly it is not yet.
Kendra in Mandarin. Kendra, hi. You're a teacher?
Yes, I am.
Okay, go ahead, Kendra.
Well, what I'd like to say is that in the state of Florida, the law holds that Florida teachers are held to a higher standard of moral and or ethical conduct in and outside of the classroom. So if, for example, a teacher is arrested with a DUI charge or drunken disorderly charge or possession of marijuana, not only can they be disciplined at their school, but they could actually lose their license and certification to teach in Florida. And so the flip side of that is if we're going to be held accountable to a higher standard than all other citizens in ethics and morality, would people agree that then it is incumbent upon us to responsibly make decisions to protect our students and keep them healthy?
Thanks for that, Kendra. Assuming by that you'd prefer to every child in your classroom be masked, I'm taking from your comments. Okay, thank you for that, Kendra. Be safe. Chris Hand.
Well, first of all, Kendra, thank you for your service as a teacher. My mother was a teacher for almost 40 years, including many of those in the Duval County Public School System. So, and I was a student of teachers in the Duval County Public School System, so really appreciate your service. I think you raise a really good point, and it's a point that also goes to the justification for the governor's executive order and for the rules that resulted from it. The justification was not rooted in the Constitution anywhere, even though that is the ultimate governing authority in Florida. It was rooted in something called the Parents' Bill of Rights, which the legislature passed in this past session. And the provision of the Parents' Bill of Rights that, you know, that the executive order relied upon was the idea that parents have the right to make health care decisions for their own children, which I think we all agree with. But of course, one of the most important principles of American democracy is the idea that we cannot assert our individual rights in ways that infringe or interfere with the rights of others. And if a child comes to school without a mask and spreads COVID, then other parents have been denied the right to make healthcare decisions for their children. For that matter, to your point, teachers have been denied the right to make healthcare decisions for themselves. So I think for a variety of reasons, including that one, the justification for this executive order and the resulting rules also is legally ineffective.
Tom on the West Side. Go ahead, Tom.
Good morning. Yes, I'm just wondering where the city, the school board, and even the governor's office stands with regard to liability if a child should be either seriously injured through COVID or actually die.
Thanks for that question. There are already lawsuits moving on this type of problem, Chris, and more to be expected?
I think no question. And look, we certainly hope that the type of lawsuit that Tom references will never be necessary, because we all hope that no child gets sick and no child dies as a result of COVID. But of course, we have to rely on the advice of medical experts, many of whom you've had on the show, Melissa. We're hearing from across the community and across the country that, you know, without masking and without vaccinations for kids under a certain age, it is very possible there could be kids who are hurt by COVID. So we have to anticipate that those types of lawsuits are coming. There is a principle called sovereign immunity that governs to what extent local governments and state government can be liable in the event of personal injuries as a result of government action or government negligence. But I think, unfortunately, given what the medical experts are telling us, we can probably expect those types of lawsuits to follow the ones that have already been filed.
Mike in St. John's. Hi, Mike. How are you? Go ahead.
Good morning. I have a question and then actually two questions. So what happens if the parents don't want the child to get vaccinated and the child wants to get vaccinated? That's number one. Can they get the vaccine without their parents' permission? Mm-hmm. And what about divorcees? Okay, children that have, you know, two different households and two and a mother here and a father there. One of them wants their child to get vaccinated, the other one doesn't. What kind of dilemma does that cause?
You know, Mike, there are so many legal issues like this that have been born out of this whole problem. Let's begin with the issue of teens. Of course, the reason parents are so concerned about this whole thing right now, Chris, is that children under 12 can't get vaccinated. Those 12 and older can. And the issue of parental consent, I believe, varies by state. Is that right?
That's correct. And this is not, you know, that in particular, that sort of area of health law is not my particular expertise. But in most cases, obviously, parental consent is required for you know, a child to have any kind of health procedure. People who are healthcare lawyers may have a better sense of when that consent can be overcome, but it is a basic principle in this state that if you're under the age of 18 and, you know, you want a health procedure, typically that requires parental consent. Again, we'll defer to healthcare lawyers on what exceptions to that might be. Dan also asked about sort of the family law implications. I'm not a family law attorney, but oftentimes those types of decisions are decided in the divorce decree, you know, whether a parent, which parent has the authority to make those types of decisions as well. I think what the question really points out is just how understandably confused and scared parents across the state are right now by this situation. Melissa, I've talked to some parents over the last several days who don't know where to turn, who are very concerned about where this is going to go. There's not good information out there. The law on this, to some extent, is still in flux. So it's you know, it's not just it's an unfortunate situation for everybody. Unfortunate for kids, unfortunate for teachers, of course, unfortunate for healthcare workers who are just overwhelmed by the dire situation in hospitals and other healthcare facilities right now. And of course, very unfortunate for parents who are having to grapple with exactly these kinds of questions that the caller just asked without a lot of good guidance right now.
That's right. We've heard from so many parents as well here at WJCT. Lots of emails and tweets as we speak with attorney Chris Hand. Here's one from Paul in St. John's County. DeSantis doesn't want to have to enforce this order. He just wanted the headline. If it gets overturned, he will just fundraise and campaign on it. Rob emails the show. The legal wrangling by DeSantis to force his will on the citizens of Florida is all for partisan politics, and it will lose in the courts. My understanding is the loser in these lawsuits will foot the bill for the verdict. It will be millions for his lawsuit against Google alone. That's a separate issue about social media and deplatforming. Will the Florida taxpayers be held fiscally responsible for these errant overreaches? Rob, the answer is yes. The taxpayers will be paying for the court costs for all of these matters by the governor that are being challenged on an array of issues. Recent reporting found that attorneys for the state on all of these lawsuits are being paid over $600 an hour. So yes, taxpayers will be on the hook for millions on this and other matters. And, you know, there are so many tweets, I can't get to them all, Chris, but in the main, people are asking constitutional questions. So I'm glad that you are on the show to explain all of this to our listeners. Let me get to a few more calls. Daryl in St. Augustine. Daryl, go ahead.
Good morning. If DeSantis wants to deduct the salary and the amount is $600,000, could you, this attorney or one other attorney, please start a GoFundMe site? I got money to put in it. I'd like to raise $1 million to give these people that stood up to this, to stood up for this issue, a bonus for standing up to big government.
Daryl, thank you for that. You know, it's my understanding, Chris Hand, that Democrats in the Florida Senate say they will begin a GoFundMe for Florida school officials if the governor follows through and the Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran follow through on their threat to withhold the paychecks of these people. So
that's correct, Melissa. I think it was sort of indicated yesterday that, you know, the Senate Democratic leader Lauren Book and Senator Jason Pizzo, Bobby Powell, and some others are talking about setting up sort of a crowdfunding type account like you're referring to in the event there's deduction. But there's also potentially help coming from Washington. The White House press secretary said yesterday in her briefing that the Biden administration has directed the U.S. Department of Education to look into ways that they might be able to help, with funding to local school districts that lose money as a result of the governor's executive order and other enforcement efforts. So there's a variety of efforts out there, whether it's crowdfunding, whether it's help from federal government. And by the way, that's why you're seeing kind of lawsuits filed in federal court as well. The federal government has a very significant role to play in education. They already are involved in federal government funding. If anyone wants to see some good information about how schools are actually funded between local, state, and federal government, I encourage you to follow Gary Fineout from Politico on Twitter, as he had a pretty long thread yesterday about how education funding works in Florida. But there are a variety of different groups trying to work together and help school systems potentially fill the gap if any money is withheld as a result of state action on mask mandate.
Last night on Twitter, Jimmy Patronis, Florida's chief financial officer, tweeted this out: giving money straight to a public official by using GoFundMe to affect an outcome sounds a lot like bribery, he said, Chris.
Well, and I also noticed that some other public officials responded very quickly and explained why a variety of provisions of the law to kind of help rebut the chief financial officer's, supposition on that provision. But, I think what we're, again, pointing out here is the really difficult position that school boards find themselves in. While it appears that the state is looking to withhold a lot less funding than was originally envisioned, school board members obviously have other concerns as well. For people who watch or listen to the Leon County meeting last night, there was clearly some concern that the governor might exercise his authority to remove county officials from office. In Article 4, Section 7 of the Florida Constitution, it provides the governor with some power to remove local officials from office. Now, I would argue that none of these particular provisions involve that, they invoke such things as malfeasance or misfeasance or neglect of duty, inability to perform official duties. I would argue that none of those apply. In fact, school board members around the state who are passing mask mandates and trying to keep kids and teachers safe from COVID are fulfilling the most important parts of their duties in office, primarily to support and defend the Florida Constitution, which includes those provisions that give school boards the exclusive authority to operate, control, and supervise public schools.
We'll continue to follow it. In the meantime, always great to get your insights. Chris Hand, government law attorney, co-author of America, the Owner's Manual, with former governor and Senator Bob Graham, co-writing that with him, and some other expertise he shares. It's always good to get your insights, Chris. Thanks.
Thank you, Melissa.
And much more still ahead. Later in the hour, why the Cooking Channel thinks one local chef's food is fried and true. That's coming up, but up next.
Some people are wearing masks, which is an improvement, because before Chief Judge Mahan did that, basically no one was wearing a mask. There's still a lot of people who aren't wearing masks, and some of them are actually judges.
There's a new mask order back in effect in local courts, but lawyers say it's being ignored, even by the judges. That's next. Well, of course, mask mandates are a hot topic again, whether they are for school, work, or a local courtroom. Our North Florida Judicial Circuit has brought back a mask mandate for courts in this three-county region on the order of Chief Judge Mark Mahan. But local attorneys say the mask mandate isn't really being followed, even by some of the judges. For more, I spoke with Jacksonville criminal defense attorney Janet Johnson. Janet Johnson, good to be with you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
So you're in courtrooms all the time as a local defense attorney. The Chief Judge Mark Mahan has reinstituted a mask mandate for this circuit, all the courtrooms around North Florida. What are you observing?
Some people are wearing masks, which is an improvement, because before Chief Judge Mahan did that, basically no one was wearing a mask. But there's still a lot of people who aren't wearing masks, and some of them are actually judges, which is kind of alarming and puts you in an awkward position because you really can't say to the judge, I want you to wear a mask. So, you know, they're going through a little process when you go into the courthouse door where they ask you, do you have COVID? Have you had symptoms of COVID? They don't ask if you're vaccinated, interestingly, and then they make sure that you have a mask, but then you see people kind of either taking them off or wearing them around their chins, and a lot of those people are courtroom personnel, people who work at the courthouse.
Mm. And you've brought this to the chief judge's attention, right?
Yeah, I did. You know, a lot of us are kind of apoplectic. There's some judges that are doing Zoom, and they're kind of doing it on their own. Most judges are not letting you do Zoom, although maybe that's going to change. You know, and the chief judge is in an untenable position. I understand it's difficult. You know, he suggested that you bring it to the attention of the presiding judge. Sometimes the presiding judge is a person not wearing a mask, so obviously that's kind of a no-go. I don't know how you do that.
There's a real power dynamic. Yeah. I mean, you can't afford to upset the judge that you're arguing in front of.
Yeah, and you're just, you know, as an attorney, you're kind of, you know, conditioned to respect the judge and not question the judge unless it's, you know, a ruling or in a setting of an argument. So, yeah, it's an awkward position. They're some distance from you. You know, they're up on the bench, but, you know, we know the Delta variant is different and highly contagious. Even if you are vaccinated, you're at risk. And there are judges who have gotten COVID. So there isn't, you know, it's not that there are people who can get it and can't get it. I don't know the vaccination status of judges. I mean, there's so many unknown things. And then you compare the, you know, family law attorneys are apparently still conducting their hearings and business on Zoom. So, you know, we're in a position where we're kind of, it's like being a frontline worker, I guess. And that's the risk that everyone's going through right now. But, you know, Zoom is working and now we're not doing it when things seem to be really going badly in our community.
Hmm. Right. I mean, defense attorneys and prosecutors have to go to court. There is rampant COVID in the local jail, and some of those suspects and inmates are making court appearances. So there's a back and forth between incarcerated people and the court system. Is that driving part of your concern?
Yeah, I mean, they do have a quarantine list, and they have people they supposedly don't bring over who are on that list, although I've seen that, you know, not be followed. You know, when people get out of jail, they are summoned to go to court within a few days, so it's not as if there's a universe of people who are only in jail, because mm-hmm. everyone who gets arrested gets processed through the jail, gets out, and, you know, could have COVID. And then, you know, a lot of defense attorneys are getting sick. I mean, pretty much every day in court, you hear about another lawyer who is out and very ill and has tested positive, and someone from his firm or her firm is covering, and you know that they were just working with that person. I mean, it's just, you know, we're at a tipping point, and I think we're going over the edge a little bit, and it's all avoidable. And I think that's the frustration, because Zoom was working really well. I mean, I know that there was some criticism that maybe we weren't resolving cases as readily and easily. And if you're not in a courtroom talking to the prosecutor directly, it is harder, I suppose. You just have to do the work outside of the courtroom. But maybe that's worth it to sort of stop this spread of this, you know, communicable disease that I think, you know, we had a good grasp on when we were doing it remotely.
Hmm. So will attorneys be speaking collectively to judges or the chief judge about this to raise a concern?
Yeah, I know the Florida Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers have basically said we want to go back to Zoom. The Supreme Court, which, you know, has kind of been the leader in, you know, when they issue an edict, then our courthouse will follow it. They've said that they should make Zoom available. It's not mandated at this point. Things aren't closed at this point. And I know a lot of defense attorneys who are basically saying, you know, we want to do Zoom. And I think some judges are allowing that. It's just, you know, there isn't a uniform policy. And I think that's what's sort of disconcerting. If you have to go to court because Judge X doesn't allow Zoom, even if Judge Z allows Zoom, you're kind of stuck at the courthouse. So it's crowded over there. I mean, you know, when you go to an injunction hearing and there's still a lot of people in a courtroom and juvenile court, you know, it's not that different than being in the courthouse pre-pandemic. And, you know, the mask, it's better, but it's not uniformly enforced.
Well, thanks for the update from inside the courthouse. Criminal defense attorney Janet Johnson will continue to follow this. Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, if you tune into the Cooking Channel tonight, you will see some familiar local faces, including Jacksonville chef Kenny Gilbert. He runs Silky's in Springfield. And maybe even our very own WJCT producer, Heather Schatz. What's this all about? Well, Chef Kenny is on the line now to tell us more. Hey, Kenny Gilbert, always good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Hey. Hey, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. So you're going to be on the Cooking Channel tonight on a show called Food Paradise. Tell us all about it.
Oh, gosh. So the O'Malley Production Company reached out to me a couple of months ago, or several months ago now, and said, hey, you know, we've been checking out your restaurant, and we want to feature you on an episode for Food Paradise. And I was like, wow, that's great. So we scheduled it. They came out May 17th, and we had a huge 12-hour shoot at the restaurant where we were able to bring in some of our favorite fans that enjoy the restaurant. And then they asked me to cook some specific dishes that they've seen comments on online to be featured during the segment.
Now, this is a segment about foods that they call fried and true, fried foods. So what did you fry up for them?
Well, I still can't mention what I...
You can't tell us?
I can't, no. Like, but what I can say is that it's going to be highlighting the items that we serve on Saturday's daily menus. I can't say that.
Okay, so if people come to Silky's in Springfield, they can check out some of Chef Kenny's delicious menu. Okay, so what was the filming like? You filmed this back in May in the restaurant? Yeah, with some local folks.
Yeah, so what happened was I had to be there at 6 o'clock in the morning. I had to have all the dishes scaled out. We had to have five, and you know, they wanted five full sets of each dish. So it was a lot of prep work involved. And then from there, their team came in, set up cameras, and we did the recipes for, I think we highlighted like four or five dishes. So it was a lot of pre-taping before all the guests were able to arrive. But it was a lot of fun. It was great to be back in front of the camera and working with the crew. They were amazing.
That's right. You've been on Food Network shows and one on Top Chef. Our own producer, Heather Schatz, and a friend of the show, Renee Parenteau, I think are going to be in the audience on tonight's show. So we'll see some familiar faces.
Yes, yes. And I was very excited to be able to invite some people that I feel that, you know, have been very supportive of me and my career, and also of Silky's and what we do, and to be able to, you know, get them to, you know, participate was very exciting. So I'm very happy about it.
Now, it's been a rough road for restaurant owners in this pandemic. Tell us how you've been, and particularly lately with this latest surge of the virus, and how you're dealing with that as a restaurant owner.
Gosh. So when we opened this concept, me and my wife and partner, we discussed what do we think can be sustainable even during this time. And, you know, so we start off building by a takeout model with counter service, so that when you come in, you can place your order. Here's your table number. We've already given you your drink. It's very hands off. You know, everything is self-serve. You know, the food is delivered to you. And with that model, it's easy for us to basically downscale staff if we have to, if it's really, really slow. And then if it gets busier, we really don't have to add too many more people on. So from that standpoint, labor is usually, you know, one of your biggest killers besides some of your other controllables in a business. But we're able to control it and keep a skeleton crew of people that are dedicated and love what we do. And that way they're always getting their hours because of the way that it's set up. So we've been doing okay. You know, we picked up some caterings, which has been very, very good for us and, you know, amazing. But as far as the restaurant, our you know, the neighbors in Springfield, you know, everyone is very supportive. They come in all the time. So that's been very helpful. I think it's hurting us from people that maybe wanting to drive in from some of the other areas, like during the week, maybe, like whether they're coming in from Ponte Vedra or Oakleaf or Fernandina. We tend to see some of those people coming in over the weekend. But I think right now with this surge, you know, people are scared. I mean, kids are going back to school. We're having to deal with that. And just the fear of going out to eat and being a large crowd, people are fearful of. But they know that they can order takeout through us as well, which has been our model. So I'm even working on a I'm actually working on a program where we're going to be able to ship out food from the restaurant, and we're going to have pre-orders set up, and I can literally send you our biscuits, our fried chicken, and everything all throughout the country.
Oh, that's great.
I'm doing it on my own because I've been talking to a lot of people, like, you know, Gloria Williams, the foot nanny out in California. We've been going back and forth talking, and she's like, man, I would love to be able to have your biscuits out here or your fried chicken. And so I've been working on a packaging system to make it where, you know, mail orders are going to be a reality because I know that, you know, where we are right now, people are, you know, there's going to be another halt to people going out and because of this variant. So I figured I needed to constantly keep looking at ways to generate revenue and keep the staff working.
Absolutely. People can learn a little bit more about this on your website. meet@silkies.com. It's Silkies Chicken and Champagne Bar in historic Springfield. You know, people have gotten used to this, Kenny, and certainly this is the way to go right now. And it's a good way to support a locally owned business like yours.
Yes, it is. And I'm so grateful and thankful for everyone that comes in. I mean, it's a really hard time. There's people at different stress levels. But we're doing everything we can to just cook, you know, good food and diverse food as well for our neighborhood and our community. And the support we've gotten from people coming in on a consistent basis is amazing. I actually celebrated my birthday yesterday, and I had a guest, you know, Greg and Aisha Mundy. They came in earlier. They brought me a gift, and you know, which was a nice surprise, and because I was at the restaurant working, and then my wife and some other, you know, friends, and you know, my sous chef, the restaurant, they had a surprise. They had, you know, we had some food catered from one of my favorite restaurants in the town, Pattaya Thai on King. So Russ sent over a whole buffet of food for me to eat.
Oh, that's great.
So like, you know, I really love Jacksonville, and I love the community part of it. I mean, sometimes, you know, you don't hear about the really good that actually happens in a lot of places.
There is such a lot of it. Let me not to cut you off, but we have to say goodbye. And I want to mention, tune into the Cooking Channel tonight at 10 o'clock, and it will rerun Thursday morning 2 a.m. And check out Chef Kenny Gilbert of Silkies in Springfield and friends. We'll be watching.
Thank you very much.
And still to come.
And it's a comedy film festival where we bring on local comedians, local filmmakers, local musicians.
LOL Jax, it's film festival and some other good news for your midweek. We'll be right back.
Ascension St. Vincent's. Care is listening and delivering personalized plans from a team of specialists dedicated to providing the latest technology and treatment at every step. Information and appointments at getjaxhealthcare.com. Announcing Vickers Landing at Oak Bridge, bridging retirees with an all-new Ponte Vedra Beach community featuring new homes, a resort lifestyle, and a life plan for every stage of aging. Information at vickerslanding.com.
Business Results LLC is committed to helping you coach your teams to their potential. Business Results is the only firm in the U.S. that combines the power of the predictive index with the insights of Cotill. BusinessResultsLLC.com.
I'm Robin Young. Director Sean Hader immersed herself in the world of children of deaf adults, or CODAs, for her new film, and she learned how kids connect their parents to the hearing world.
You're the conduit between these two points, and your job is to sort of deliver information and receive information, but in a way you don't know who you are.
Next time, here and now.
Today at 1 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, Kenan Thompson. Nominated for an Emmy for his performances on Saturday Night Live, he's been with the show longer than any cast member in SNL history. He also has an Emmy nomination for his leading role in the NBC sitcom Kenan. He plays a TV talk show host grieving the death of his wife and raising two children. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Who owns your identity? For Amanda Knox, she says it shouldn't be Hollywood. She's hitting out at the creators of a new movie which uses her wrongful murder conviction as a plot line. But the film's director says it's not about her. We speak to Amanda Knox next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, come on out and share a few laughs this weekend at the Mosh Planetarium. It's the LOL Jacks Comedy Film Festival. I got a preview from festival co-founder Monique Madrid. Hey, Monique, tell us about LOL Jacks Film Festival.
Well, LOL Jacks Film Festival is Love Our Locals While Laughing Out Loud, and it's a comedy film festival where we bring on local comedians, local filmmakers, local musicians, and we partner with local businesses to have a celebration at Mosh. And we have the screenings at the Planetarium, at Brian Gunning Planetarium, and we have an after party on the rooftop August 13th and August 15th.
And this is a great platform for the local film and performing community, it sounds like.
Yeah, it is. It is. It gives them a chance because we've noticed that one, the arts community, not many people feel like they are in touch with it. And then also, too, within the communities, the filmmakers, they have their own little circle. The comedians, they have their own circle. Same thing with the musicians and the artists. They just need to collaborate together because sometimes comedians can be actors in these filmmakers' films, or they can be writers, and the musicians can do the score. And filmmakers, they can actually film the videos or do demo reels for the comedians, but they can all work together. So we wanted to use our platform to kind of bridge everybody together, but also too so that the community itself can realize that we have talent in the city. They don't have to wait till Steven Spielberg makes his next film. Mm-hmm. We have talented artists right here. You know,
yeah. And this is going to be comedy. And gosh knows we could all use a few laughs right now.
Yeah, for sure, 100%. And that was the whole purpose. We made LOL Jacks we created it back in 2016 with that premise in mind, you know, of people need laughs because they're going through a lot. And unfortunately, here we are, 2021, and we need it now more than ever. So I'm grateful for the gift that comedy and what we do can bring smiles and bring joys to people who are having a bad day, having a bad week, having a bad year, and just going through a lot of different situations. So I'm grateful for that forever gift of giving some positivity back to people who need it.
Now, this is Friday and Sunday at the Mosh in the Planetarium. Masks required? What sort of COVID measures are you doing?
Absolutely. So we did this last year. We did an in-person event last year as well, and it's going to be the same protocol. Everyone will have to wear a mask, whether vaccinated or not. We will do temperature checks at the door. We do ask, and it'll be in the program as well, our paper program that we give out, but we ask that people exercise 6 feet, you know, social distancing. We are going to have spread seating. We are doing a limited capacity, and we are ensuring that sanitizer is everywhere, even using the elevators. Not many people can go in the elevators. And so we partner really well with Mosh. And I'm grateful that we are, as well as Mosh, is not only trying to throw a fun event, but also taking the health of everyone seriously. And last year we had several screenings and we had no COVID issues because we took that protocol seriously. We're even going to have a COVID compliance officer in place to ensure that people are wearing their masks. So we're taking it seriously.
Wow. Thank you so much and have fun. Monique Madrid, she is co-creator of the LOL Jax Film Festival this Friday and Sunday at the Mosh. Check it out at loljax.com. Have fun.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right, and here's some other good news for your Wednesday. Do you know a talented local artist? The Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville is now accepting nominations for their 45th Annual Arts Awards in 9 categories. Nominate a talented person in your life at culturalcouncil.org. Speaking of local talent, artist Cassidy Ramos will be at the Kummer Museum this Friday for a meet and greet. This is free with museum admission, and it starts at 5:30 p.m. Pastor Mark Griffin and Wayman Temple AME Church are hosting another 25 for 25 event Saturday. Pastor Griffin and the church are offering a $25 gift certificate to anyone 25 years or under who comes out to get vaccinated. This is in partnership with Agape Family Health. Now, the city of Jacksonville is doing its part, funding 3 new COVID testing sites across the city and 2 additional new sites to be operated by the Duval County Health Department. Find the location nearest you by checking coj.net, or you can look on our website too. And in partnership with Nomi Health, St. Johns County is offering free COVID testing starting Monday at the St. Johns County Agricultural Center. This site will be open 7 days a week with no appointment necessary. So folks, go on out and get a COVID test if you need it. And please go get vaccinated too, if you have not already done so. And if you have some good news for us to put on our weekly What's Good Wednesday menu, just drop us a line. Thanks for listening too. And thanks to all of our guests and callers, along with producer Heather Schatz, Director Josh Torres, Associate Producer Catherine Hobbs, Editorial Director Jessica Palumbo, and Digital Editor Bill Bortsfield, along with the entire WJCT News team. Get in touch. Our email is firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Miss anything from today's show? Catch our podcast. It's up later today on all platforms, wherever you like to listen. You can also download the WJCT app and listen to all of our great content right through the app. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News, 89.9 Jacksonville. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Be safe, everyone, and please wear your mask.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.